You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with Lyda Winfield. Lyda, thanks so much for being with me today.
Yeah, thank you. So nice to be here. Thank you.
Lyda, where are you now? Where are you working? Where is your studio and home?
Yeah, so I live in Middlebury, Vermont right now. I'm a visiting professor at the at Middlebury College. So I just completed my second year. I'm about to start my third year here.
Well, that's exciting. So while you're there, being a visiting professor, a teaching artist, basically, are you working on other things of your own at the moment?
Yeah. So my work is a mixture of dance and theater, storytelling, spoken word, and visual art. For the last 10 years, I have had a show that's called In Search of Air that's about learning to read. I didn't learn to read until I was a grown-up and am a very, very learning disabled person. And so that experience has really shaped a lot of my view of the world and obviously then has greatly impacted my art making. So that's been sort of what my history has been of the last decade, really. And then I'm obviously a teacher, and I think of teaching as a pillar stone inside of my art making. And then I have some new work that I'm slowly working on. I have four other collaborators, and we are making a new piece that is called Imaginary.
And that will be a piece that it incorporates you as a dancer and choreographer and
yeah, artist. So I'm in the work as well as and a little bit of the outside eye and kind of the crafter of it, although we work quite collaboratively.
And it'll be a theatrical piece, obviously. That'll be how long is there? What are the parameters of it?
Yeah, so the piece, so we actually premiered it at the Flynn Center for the Performing Arts in Burlington, Vermont in February. That was a very good beginning, and the work doesn't feel done, as I think so often happens with artists, is that you sort of don't really know what it's going to be until you put it out there, and then you learn a lot from that experience. And so we're in the beginning stages of thinking about what we learned from that and then our recrafting for sort of our second draft, if you will. And we're about to go to the Vermont Performance Lab, which is in Guilford, Vermont, for a 7-day residency. And then from there, we'll go on to Jacob's Pillow in the Berkshires and do a half an hour version of the show there.
That sounds fantastic. So let's go back a little bit, perhaps, and talk about In Search of Air, because, of course, your story is quite extraordinary. And I imagine that production is also very close to you and seems like, if I can say this, a kind of seminal work for you.
Yes, right. So that piece really has been a very important piece inside my career. And so that show, I made the first draft of that in 2011 and then has really been a staple for me. And what's sort of interesting about that particular piece is, so obviously it's my true story and it's my personal story about learning to read or how come I didn't learn to read, depending on which way you want to think about it, and really a look at the educational system and ultimately is a celebration, if you will, of how important the arts were for me and for so many of us in our paths as human beings, and that part of what I speak about inside that work is I had this very odd parallel experience as a young person where in school I really learned that I was dumb and was not valuable. And then after school, in the context of dance or theater or visual art, I learned that I was brilliant, and those two experiences grew equally at the same time, kind of next to each other. And so that's a lot of what the work is sort of giving honor, if you will, to the value of art making, and also really encouraging educators and our educational system to think bigger about what does it mean to be smart, and what does success look like, and kind
well,
of how
I mean,
we...
also the role of the arts, right? I mean,
yes,
if you could
yes.
get into that a little bit in your life, what role did the arts play? I mean, we could talk about education, which of course is a kind of broken system in so many ways, but the arts are often completely sidelined in traditional education. So how did the arts affect what you were doing? And I mean, you can talk about it in the context of In Search of Air, but I'm curious how that's expressed in Search of Air, and also actually how that happened to you, because that sounds like it was an enormously important part of your growth and becoming an artist.
Yes, right, absolutely. So it's hard for me to imagine the life that I would have if there hadn't been art inside my life. So be it that it was the visual art class inside of a very sad and lonely day in public school. And then after school, I took dance and theater classes as a young child. And then when I was 14, I joined a multi-generational dance theater company. And so my best friend and I were the youngest members of the company as 14-year-olds, and then the oldest was 80. And it was this pretty amazing small group of women where we made dances through improvisation and through interdisciplinary work, and we made our costumes and sang and, you know, danced in abandoned buildings and on rooftops and in fields. And so I think those experiences were really lifelines, if you will, to a sense of a much bigger world. I often say that that I learned that the world was big, and that I had a valuable place inside of it through art, in a way that I really didn't see at all through the traditional classroom setting.
And so that began a whole, I mean, in a sense, that's where I would imagine Search of Air starts or is partly about, and or correct
yeah.
me if I'm wrong, but then what happened after that experience? That was, you were a young teenager, but that opened up many doors for you. That led to what next?
Yeah, right. It's a good question. So I think the way that Search of Air sort of operates is that it shows the duality of these two experiences that happen at the same time. And obviously, In Search of Air is a performance. And so in some ways, the art kind of speaks for itself, right? So I am dancing and telling the stories in a very crafted, performative way. And so it automatically shows the skills that I gained inside that field, inside those experiences. And then, you know, it's funny, I think, like, as a young person, I, maybe like so many of us, was really naive in my hope that then my art-making skills would mean that at some point I would be discovered and I would, you know, be successful as an artist, as a dancer. And so therefore it was a way to kind of see a long-term line when I couldn't see it another way. And then sadly, of course, you know, what really happened is that I graduated from high school and, you know, I didn't get discovered, because that's not really how it works in
right.
the field at all. And so it was a very long and kind of meandering path about finding my way and my voice and my creativity as a successful place really out in the working world, which, you know, I think we all understand that working artists, it's a complicated and ultimately non-traditional path, even if there's a lot of us that take it.
Yeah, that's of course what everybody talks about in a lot of these interviews that I do, that that moment that when we're not discovered or recognize that, and then what happens next. So there's of course a big gap between then and then when you first did In Search of Air.
Yeah.
How did, okay, if we could talk a little bit more about that production, what was the length of it and where was that first produced and how was that received? Because that's also a kind of content that people aren't normally exposed to, period, right?
Right. Yes. So I continued to make dance and theater pieces throughout my whole life, sort of regardless of, be it that I was a dog walker or a breakfast line cook or whatever it was, sort of in that path of trying to find my way. And then eventually what ended up happening is that I went to Goddard College, which is in Plainfield, Vermont. And Goddard is this totally wild, really interesting college, and I actually ended up getting my MFA from there. And part of what Goddard does such a good job at is like really pushing you to be clear about, okay, what are you making, why are you making it, and how are you going to do it. And so it sort of forced me in this really lovely way to get clear, or to get clean, if you will, about what I was doing. And so it was actually in graduate school that I made In Search of Air. And I felt compelled that I have an interesting story, like so many of us really do. We all have such rich and complicated lives, and also felt the need to be at the table with educators and with artists, thinking equally about those things, about how we can really value multiple types of intelligence and creative thinking. And so basically, I made In Search of Air as my thesis project, if you will, and so first performed it there. And then slowly, as those things go, was able to network it and sell it to different theaters. And then I quickly actually realized that who was really going to be interested in that particular piece.
You network and presented it to several theaters. That's no simple task then for anybody to network it and present it to a lot of theaters. That was also, I would imagine, a lot of knowledge you were getting at that point about how to present something like this to different theaters and also how to network.
Yes, right. So again, I think I had past experience as a performer, be it that I was in other people's work or in other projects of my own, and so my goal was to get a gig from a gig, right? So I knew that if I could kind of get in the door someplace, that there was the possibility of another one, be it that it was from someone in the audience or saying, who else do you think would be interested in this piece? And what then kind of unfolded from there is that it was really clear to me that In Search of Air, different than other creative pieces that I had made, could really have some legs in the educational world. And so I started networking and thinking about it as sort of an alternative keynote, if you will, even though it was a performance where I took my shoes off and danced and, didn't have a PowerPoint, that I could market it to educational conferences and that they were really interested in it, and schools and universities and folks studying special ed or education thinking about cognitive diversity were really interested in it. And so I was actually able to make more headway in that path than I was actually in the dance and theater world. Which obviously one kind of builds on the other, mostly in relationship to confidence, but it was surprising to me and lovely that then was a path that I could take.
That is exciting. And, cognitive diversity is a very interesting phrase that I haven't come across before. And so tell me a little bit more about that, because, of course you're a teaching artist too, and you're still doing more of these productions. The idea of cognitive diversity, does that play a role in how you teach?
Yes, of course. So I think because of my experience as a young person, I essentially was in a segregated special ed classroom for the majority of my education, although not all of it. So I've just done a lot of thinking about access and what is it that makes something accessible. And so much of that is really about environment, and that we can, it's not easy to do, but that we can shift environment in order to welcome a wider spectrum of thinkers. And that all of us, like you and I included, you know, just have different brains from each other. And that I think because we in school are generally taught the same way, there's sort of a belief that there's a better way to learn or a better way to think, and that there's a value system inside of that about, you know, that science is more valuable than art or whatever it is that kind of make, or linear thinking is more valuable than circular thinking or abstract thinking. And so I use the term cognitive diversity as a way to say, you know, our brains, of course, are different from each other in the same way that our bodies are. And so if we're able to acknowledge that and think about that as an asset, then it's actually really lovely to then think, okay, how am I going to teach to a full classroom? How am I going to welcome all bodies and all abilities and all brains? And it's my job as the educator to problem solve how I'm going to do that.
And that sounds like a problem that's wonderful to tackle head on. It also sounds like a complex one and an enormously important one that we wish the whole educational system was tackling. As you do it, you're developing your own techniques, I would imagine, and system for tackling that, especially with a full classroom where you have all these different students with all different, cognitive abilities, if that's the right term.
Yeah, I think it's true, and I don't think that I'm, you know, necessarily groundbreaking. I think there's lots of folks thinking about cognitive diversity or thinking about universal design for learning or thinking about kinesthetic learning, right? So it's estimated that 50 to 75% of all human beings are kinesthetic learners, meaning that we learn by doing, by our bodies in addition to our brains. And so obviously, I teach dance, and I teach in the field of physicality, but my teaching has had huge spectrum, right? So, you know, taught in homeless shelters or with business people or, trained educators, kindergarten teachers through PhDs around kinesthetic learning and so just endless populations, if you will, of people. And so the kinesthetic part is obviously right there inside of teaching dance or storytelling. But it's also really recognizing then that not everyone feels strength and joy connected to their bodies. And so some folks feel more comfortable as book learners. And so how do I actually welcome them is my challenge versus, like, I think most traditional academic teachers have the, or classroom teachers have the struggle of needing to welcome physicality. I have the struggle of needing to welcome book learners.
That's great. It's a wonderful challenge. So before I ask you the last question, it's wonderful talking about, you know, what you've done and what you're about to do in this new project. Is there anything else you want to mention about the work that you're doing now? You can plug something or say anything you want. There will be links in the interview, of course, to other things as well as images. But is there anything else you want to plug or mention before I ask you one more question?
Yeah, thank you. So, so this new work that I'm beginning is called Imaginary. And so my team is Ellen Smith Ahern, Marie Romalia, Laurel Jenkins, and Joseph Hall. And the work that we're really thinking about is how imagination impacts our potential. And ultimately, maybe a better way to say that is, you know, how I imagine who you are changes or shifts how you behave. So my imagination is actually a very powerful. So we're in the throes and grappling, and so we, you know, we have this, our next gig is at Jacob's Pillow on August 15th, and we got my first national grant. So we got a grant through the National Performance Network, which is based out of New Orleans. And our commissioning partners are the Flynn Center for the Performing Arts and Jacob's Pillow, The Yard and Martha's Vineyard, and then Middlebury Performing Arts Series. So it's been a lovely process and a challenging one and really good new learning for me.
It's fantastic. I'm excited to hear more about it. So, Lida, before we go, I wanted to ask you what you're reading at the moment. I ask everybody that at the end. I'm always curious.
Yeah, so it's a great question because, you know, given sort of the conversation that we're having, I think it's noteworthy that I'm not a reader. And I am an active learner, and there's so many ways to learn and get information, and books is not my way. So I'm actually not reading anything.
I'm so glad you said that. That's such an interesting answer, you know. And of course, that kind of dovetails into how you were talking about students like that. Can you listen to books though too, or you can't? That's not a way of learning.
Yeah, sure. No. So right. So I might listen to books by choice, absolutely. At different times in my life, that has been something that I have done, and is not something that I'm currently doing. But I guess when I do, I listen to podcasts or TED Talks or The Moth Hour. So I obviously like stories. But I would say that the primary way that I gain information is by listening and or by talking with people.
Because you're a kinesthetic learner, essentially, right?
Yeah, I'm a kinesthetic learner, and I'm an auditory learner. And so... So sort of sitting still with a book, although can feel lovely, you know, it isn't my preferred modality. So I'll read when I need to for work and for things like that, but it isn't the way that I actually feel the most successful as a learner.
Yeah, it's so interesting. The first time I ever heard of that concept, I think, was my first year in art school, undergraduate school, and there were other actors there, And it seems that it would be so important for all of us to know that information at an early age, how we learn, because the actors were learning just that. How do they learn, you know? And
and
that fascinated me because no one else in the school learned how they learn, only the actors,
right.
You know? And I thought, that, God, that's obviously so important.
Yes, right, yeah.
Lida, I want to thank you for talking with me today. It's really been a pleasure, and I wish you great success with your next production.
Yeah, thank you. So nice to talk to you. I really appreciate your time.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.